Hello and welcome to the Arrow Video Podcast with Sam and Dan. I'm Sam Ashurst, I'm a writer, I'm a director, and I'm a podcast person.
Hi, I'm Shay Mossifin. I am not Dan, but I am a VHS distributor, a physical media collector, and a podcaster.
That's right, and Dan is on his regularly scheduled break, so official co-host Shay will be joining us for this chat about the Warriors, and to talk about Conan next time, which I'm very excited about. But before we do that, let us break down what is so astonishing about Arrow's release of The Warriors, one of my all-time favourite movies. And my goodness, Arrow have done this film justice with this release. It's absolutely stunning. Shay, when did you first watch The Warriors? What's your history with this movie?
I rented it at a Blockbuster because of the cover.
Oh, yeah.
And then I bought it at a thrift shop because of the price. It was 25 cents. You can't argue with that, especially with that cover. Yeah. And I watched it maybe 3 or 4 times before watching it on this gorgeous 4K, which blew my mind to the level that it was like watching Suspiria for the first time on DVD after having watched the same videotape over and over again, and not having any clue that the colors were quite as bold or colorful or striking as they really were. I had no idea that The Warriors was really an epic study in nighttime cinematography, in light play, color play, using textures and environments to create such a completely gorgeous
experience. Totally, I completely agree. This was one that I owned on VHS and watched many, many, many times. I also owned the re-release, you know, the director's cut abomination, which I'm not a fan of. It is on this disc, but we did watch the theatrical release. But yeah, this, it's a stunning transfer, as you say, Shay, and comparing it to Suspiria, that leap from VHS to DVD is absolutely appropriate. You can see the shine on the electric Eliminator silk jackets like never before.
Oh my God, I would give my life savings for one of those jackets. Like, they're so amazing.
And the lighting and the colours, you know, Suspiria is a really great comparison because there's a couple of shots in this movie on this watch that really popped for me. One is every time we go back to the close-up of the lips, the DJ, kind of red light in the background there is just really, really pretty, very Argento-esque. And then there's the shot of Masai and one of the Rift's gang members whispering in his ear, and we see Masai beautifully lit and his compadre is in complete shadow right next to him.
Oh yeah,
with yellow lighting behind that.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I know comic book stuff was an influence on Walter Hill, and that's shown even more in the later version, the 2005 release, which even added like weird panels and stuff.
Yeah, that's
wasn't a fan of that.
I totally forgot about that.
Yeah.
That was not on the version that we watched.
No, we watched the theatrical cut. Just so many elements come together perfectly, from Bobby Manick's stunning costume design to the electronic score by Barry Dvorzon. And this is really, really early on in the development of electronic music. Like, synths at this point really weren't sophisticated, so the fact that they were able to get this sound onto this movie and be so influential, I think, on so many other scores is pretty incredible.
The song kills. It's so good. The moment it kicks in, you feel like you're flying. Like, and the pace of it is so frenetic and it moves you so forward. I don't know of opening credits that are more exciting than these.
The actual song itself really perfectly fits the tone and the style. Every single decision really speaks to the mix of naturalistic grit and hyper-stylization. Even the way it's shot, those whip pans and the on the street almost documentary style shots of like the empty streets of New York.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's filled with all of these crazy colorful characters, some of whom are completely terrifying, even though on paper you'd think they'd look ridiculous, but Hill makes it work.
Oh my God, yeah, the gangs have this cartoonish absurdity that Walter Hill really leaned into, and I love that he went all in, because you can't go half in on a gang called the Baseball Furies or the Electric Eliminators or the Riffs. You have to go all in, and they really do. And I love the way that they introduce the gangs in this giant rally where you get through these really driving opening credits, and then everything kind of slows down while this cult leader, charismatic lead character, Cyrus, gives a stirring argument to these struggling gangs. They're like feudal, tribalistic little mini societies fighting for their scrap of the city. And basically this leader, Cyrus, is saying, why don't we all band together and then we can take down the society that's keeping us down?
Yes.
It's actually quite stirring
in
a weird way.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of shots of the audience, of the gang members, like really taking it in. And you start to really see all the different costume designs and the different, you know, the mixture of like of faces, young, old, all cultures, all races, all walks of life. And suddenly everything goes completely haywire.
Yes.
And then we're hauling ass through the city the rest of the film.
Yeah.
And wow, it is such a good story. It's based on a real historical event in Greece that was written down by the Greek author Zephanon. So this movie is really like a quest film, but it's also kind of like a sports movie. I really liked it because every gang is almost like a team. And sometimes I found myself rooting for certain gangs to win. And sometimes it wasn't the Warriors. Like, I like the Orphans a lot. The Warriors themselves, they're complex, you know? Like, James Remar's character is actually kind of despicable at times.
Oh, yeah.
But they're also very tightly knit. They're looking out for each other. The entire city is trying to kill them. They've been wrongly accused of committing a crime. And even the cops themselves are chasing after the Warriors very much like a gang.
Yes.
They're behaving like gang members. Everybody is out to kill them. And it's so stressful.
You say it's like sports, but I can't believe this has never been turned into a video game. Like, surely someone needs to do like a Grand Theft Auto style game in the Warriors world.
Oh,
like,
my God,
that'd
be
not happened?
So good.
You mentioned the costumes and the how different everyone looks. That's all down to Bobby Mannix. Walter Hill gives her credit in his interview on this disc, and there's a couple of explorations of her work, and we get to see her original kind of sketches and designs, and they look so it's basically like the actors jumped off the page. Like, it's so close to those original concept designs, and Hill, you know, just looked at them and said, yeah, absolutely. You know, I think the only one that he had a real influence on was the Baseball Furies.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, because partly because he said he hated the Yankees, and so he wanted them to wear the Yankees uniform. But apparently he was also influenced by Kurosawa. He wanted them to like feel like samurai.
Oh,
which,
that fits.
Yeah. And but for me, they're more like kind of slasher villains. The fact that they don't speak. And
they're terrified. They don't talk. Yeah, they're like they're like violent mimes.
Yeah, they are.
Mimes are terrifying. We all know that.
Yes.
But yeah, Walter Hill is kind of known for being a Western filmmaker in so many ways. Like, a lot of his films could be arguably classified as Westerns, I guess, in disguise.
Yeah.
And Kurosawa was so influential on Westerns,
absolutely,
especially the Italian Westerns.
Yeah.
And the Warriors were so inspiring to so many Italian exploitation films of the 80s.
Yeah.
It's really fascinating to see that torch get passed. And this is really a film unlike any other of its era. Like, very, very proto-80s.
And it even this, I mean, obviously Hill has dabbled in Westerns. His best work probably is in TV, because he is very, very responsible for how Deadwood looks and feels. He directed the first episode, but he actually brought his production designer onto that show. And so the reason it looks so real and, you know, vivid and vicious is down to Hill's presence and influence on that show. But even The Warriors feels a little bit Western-y to me. Like, it is these outlaws having to make it across the plains, and, you know, when they go off with the Lizzies, that's kind of like a bar scene in a Western, you know.
It
it's
totally
like a bar
is.
Shootout.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think because this feels like a Western, because this is one of the best post-apocalyptic action movies, and because The performances are so amazing. This is absolutely one of my favorite films of all time. I actually feel weirdly pressured talking about it right now because I want to do it justice. This is how important The Warriors is to me. But yeah, we should talk about the performances. David Patrick Kelly, for me, is especially impressive. There's a reason why he has the most quoted line from this movie. The way he delivers it, the intensity of his entire performance is really, really special. And Deborah Van Valkenburgh, I really want to highlight her performance as Mercy. Again, very naturalistic, very believable, really intense, and such a great character as well. She really leaps off the screen and she doesn't take any shit, and she follows what she wants across the whole film.
I love that she's wedged in between the gangs, and I felt a little scared for her, but she had such power over them because she wasn't wearing any of the colors.
I think she completely holds her own, and from her very first moment, she's the one that really changes the course of the movie. I'm going to get on to Walter Chow's commentary properly in a minute, but he pointed out a really excellent point. There's a moment where it looks like she's about to be sexually assaulted, but they're just tearing off a part of her dress so they can light the Molotov cocktail. And it's a really wonderful metaphor for her presence in the film.
And she comes off as a villain at first because she gives the Warriors a really hard time.
Yeah, yeah. And the orphans.
She's kind of a, like, almost a Loki-like character, a little mischievous.
Yeah, yeah.
Looking out for herself, but also a romantic figure.
Yeah,
she was incredible. Something I noticed on this watch for the first time is that there are hardly any guns in this movie. There are a couple of key moments, but most of the weaponry is improvised because the characters have been stripped of their weapons when they go into this rally, mm-hmm. and they're on a truce. But then the truce is kind of broken, and there's this feeling of suspense because you don't know if the other gangs are obeying the truce, and did they actually not bring their weapons?
Yeah, yeah.
And I really love that because the filmmakers were also stripped of the usual tools that they would have.
Right, yeah,
in a film like this.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, their metaphorical tool belt was empty, and so they had to start putting in things like baseball bats, glass bottles.
Yeah, yeah.
Intimidating taunts. And like, you don't see these types of weapons in your typical street gang film. It was almost in a weird way like West Side Story.
Right.
But without the dancing.
Yeah. Now, I mentioned Walter Chow's commentary a little bit earlier, but I would like to go in depth on it a little bit because it's my favorite kind of commentary, full of brilliant visual analysis from the very first moment. It's such a joy to listen to, full of passion and intelligence. It's the kind of commentary that actually inspires me to do better, both as a critic and as a filmmaker. It's just wonderful, wonderful stuff. It made me appreciate Hill's choices even more, from the very opening shot to the multiple whip pans. I just loved this commentary so much. Genuinely one of the best I've ever heard. And both Walter's personal feelings and factual insight add so much to the picture, whether it's the history of the skinhead movement or Walter's feelings around how the Warriors represent youth. Dare I even say this commentary is emotionally moving? That's how it felt to me. Really, really genuinely worth the purchase for this commentary alone. And can Walter do commentaries for every single Arrow release? Please, Arrow, if you're listening to this, just wonderful, wonderful. And, you know, I had high expectations. I'm a fan of Walter, and this is one of my all-time favorite movies. So there were high expectations going into listening to this, but it absolutely blew them all away. So brilliant, brilliant stuff. And, you know, there's loads of great extras on here. There's a feature-length roundtable discussion featuring filmmakers who love the movie, though I should warn you, it is a Zoom meeting. When I see the words round table, I assume that people are round a table, but no, they're on Zoom. So lower expectations for that one. Also, a great new interview with Walter Hill, conducted by Heather Buckley, who I'm also a fan of. There's an appreciation of the soundtrack, an isolated score, which is just wonderful to
oh my God,
stick on in the background when you're doing other stuff. More interviews, wonderful archival special features from 2005. It's just an incredible package. And yeah, add in that audio commentary and there's enough here to keep you going for hours and hours and hours. So yeah, any final thoughts before we move on to recommendations, Shay?
Yeah, I guess I really want to talk about just how beloved and renowned The Warriors is amongst all kinds of film fans. You have horror film fans who are obsessed with it, who can quote it from beginning to end.
Yeah.
You have film critics who absolutely adore it. And this is a gritty little street movie from the late 70s.
Right.
It's one of Walter Hill's first films. I think it's Joel Silver's very first producing credit. Like, it's at least one of his first. And I mean, it's such a unique film. It's basically a violent post-apocalyptic film, but it's not actually super violent.
No, absolutely.
You know,
in
the same way that you think of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre as being gory, and then you watch it and go, actually, it's really not that gory. Like, he creates this universe where things feel so hyper-stylized, and your mind just fills in the blanks of what's going on. And yeah, I mean, it's not even in the post-apocalypse, but it feels like an alternate New York. And I love movies that talk about New York. I'm not from New York. I've only been there once. I was 11. And I heard that the mayor of New York at the time actually was really excited about this film and even visited the set with Gloria Swanson.
Oh, wow.
Like, the mayor wasn't concerned about the image that this put forth about New York. He understood this is a fantasy film. And that if anything, it would drum up some interest in the city.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting because this film was made at a really kind of low point in New York's history. You know, 1979, just 2 years before this, in 77, there'd been the kind of notorious blackout in New York. And there was a lot of gang activity at that point, loads of looting. And I think that could potentially have partially inspired The Warriors, because I think New York would have felt a lot like The Warriors at that point, with empty streets at night, everyone hiding away, and then the streets being roamed by lots of different gangs. I will say, though, that there is a positive to all of that. Apparently, the New York blackout looting, it was at the kind of very early stages of hip-hop, where there were street parties happening, but not enough people had equipment to throw their own street parties. So lots of looters focused on musical equipment, so like decks and speakers and stuff. And post-blackout, that's what led to a real explosion in hip-hop and rap music.
So, I'm so glad you said that, because you reminded me that Wu-Tang references The Warriors.
Oh, yeah.
I think Ice-T, too. Like, this film was actually super influential in hip-hop in general. Yeah.
Well, Walter Hill originally wanted The Warriors to be all black, but apparently the studio wasn't having it. And that's a real shame, because I think it could have been an even more kind of iconic and influential movie if they'd have done that. But as it stands, The Warriors is an absolutely perfect film. And it's timeless. Like, we watched this with a member of Generation Alpha.
We watched this with Dylan.
At one point, he really cheered and celebrated. And Shay said, "Oh, I'm so glad you're enjoying this, Dylan." And he said, "Well, yeah, it's cool." Like, as if, of course I'm enjoying it. So, you know, for a movie released in 1979 to still have that impact and that kind of edge as well. I think one of the reasons Dylan liked it is because it has that edge. You know, he cheered when the cop got kicked down the stairs.
Oh, he loved it.
Yeah. It was really fun watching it with him. So, yeah, The Warriors, buy it on 4K. It's astonishing. Show it to your kids. And let's move on to recommendations based on the movie. Shay, would you like to start?
I would love to. I would love to talk about 2019, After the Fall of New York, from 1983. This was an Italian Escape from New York ripoff directed by Sergio Martino. And it's far more entertaining than it should be. Just as The Warriors is based on a Greek historical event, this was based on Wagner's final work, a three-part opera called Parsifal, where a foolish hero goes on a great quest for the Holy Grail. It stars George Eastman and Michael Sobkiff. He was an actor that was cast entirely on his looks, and I guess he was still in acting school, and immediately made it into lead roles on 4 Italian films, and then fell off the face of the earth, and now he makes glass for wine companies.
Oh, wow.
in California, I think. But yeah, he's kind of like a knockoff Snake Plissken, as you would expect, and he works his way through a post-apocalyptic New York, teeming with weird stuff like a saxophone-playing mutant, there's marauding gangs, there's an underground rat-eating society, and a maniacal cult leader played by George Eastman, determined to populate the world with the last fertile woman. Heads up, he gets pretty grabby with her. It's pretty rough, but the film itself is grimy and gritty all the way through, but also very surreal. And it was made with a tremendous amount of enthusiasm by Martino. And, I mean, who can turn down an entertaining exploitation film with the care and attention instilled by mentor Mario Bava? Mario Bava did a lot of work with Sergio Martino when Sergio was really early in his filmmaking career. So, yeah, like The Warriors, it has a banging theme song performed by Oliver Onions, which is the moniker for Italian brothers and soundtrack composers Guido and Maurizio De Angelis. It's a really fantastic synth-driven driving score.
And we should actually point out that there is some rough stuff in The Warriors, and there's some really nasty homophobic language in there as well. Walter talks about that on the commentary, and I really like the point that he makes. It's partly the fact that obviously at that time, the 70s, people felt much freer to use that kind of language. Also, the character Ajax, James Remar, apparently in the script, he's described as having a propensity for mixing violence and sex. And Walter points out that he is on the extreme side of the masculine scale, or at least that's how he perceives himself. So for him, that is the worst insult that he can give, you know, this mixture of violence and sex. And Hill did actually want a gay gang in The Warriors.
Oh, yeah.
They had designs which looked very, very kind of punk, very Sex Pistols.
Mm.
And apparently the gay gang were going to be on the heroic side of the fence when it comes to the gangs. They were going to stand up for themselves, but have a dignity and a power that would have set them aside from the rest. But again, the studio didn't want to include those. So,
oh, it's kind of a shame, because Cruisin' came out, what, shortly after
this? Yeah, exactly. But let's move on to my first recommendation based on The Warriors. And you just mentioned Escape from New York. And for me, The Warriors really feels like a prequel to Escape from New York, like released in 79. Escape from New York came out in 1981. And it really felt like Carpenter was trying to do a sequel, like an unofficial direct sequel to The Warriors. It feels like a continuation of this world, from the style to the music. You could absolutely watch them back to back, and it would feel like one long movie with a time jump in the middle, perhaps with Masai growing into the Duke and the gangs taking over to the extent that they're cut off from the rest of society. If you're listening to this episode, I'm sure you've seen Escape from New York. But if you haven't, oh my God, what a treat.
Oh, I'm so jealous if you haven't, because you get to see it for the first time.
Yeah, put on The Warriors, then Escape from New York as The Chaser, and you'll see exactly what I mean. All right, what's next from you, Shay?
I've got kind of a wild card. I was going to recommend, can I talk about what I was going to recommend?
Sure.
I was going to recommend Fury Road.
Right.
Because here you are, hauling ass across the desert. But I thought that maybe...
Circular narrative, yeah, they end up where they start.
Yeah, good point. But instead, I'm going to talk about a comedy from 1980, starring David Naughton from American Werewolf in London, Michael J. Fox in one of his first roles, if not his very first feature film role, Eddie Deason, Stephen Furst, and Deborah Klinger. This is Midnight Madness, and it's an oddball comedy in a capture-the-flag-style scavenger hunt where 5 teams of eccentric weirdos are racing against each other to decipher cryptic clues planted around town by a mad college-aged genius, leading them to an unknown treasure and, most importantly, bragging rights. This was weirdly made by Disney, so it has a bit of a soft edge. They don't go too hard on any of the wacky antics. And the prize might leave you feeling like you were slapped by a wet blanket. It's not that spectacular. But it does feature some of the most hilarious nerd shenanigans on screen ever. And it has a banging disco soundtrack.
Oh, awesome.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. All right, well, last from me is another truly beautiful 4K release, one of the best in my collection. And I think the Droogs would absolutely fit into the world of the Warriors as long as they could complete the green card process. I am, of course, talking about A Clockwork Orange. And again, if you're listening to this, there's a good chance you've already seen Stanley Kubrick's most controversial film. But if you haven't, wow, stick it on as the first film in a double bill with the Warriors and prepare yourself to be blown away. Now, this was on my recommendation list quite early on, but I also learned from the commentary that the Warriors, in addition to the novel, was inspired by a New York Magazine article about the real Bronx gangs titled Are You Ready for the New Ultraviolence? So A Clockwork Orange was in the mix as an inspiration from the earliest stages of the project. And of course I recommend it. It's a Kubrick film and it is insane.
It really
just
is.
Just a touch more violent than The Warriors. But yeah, all right, let's move on to what we've been watching in the past couple of weeks.
Oh yeah, I think I can top the insanity of The Clockwork Orange.
Oh, well, let's hear it.
You want to hear?
Yes, please.
Okay, this is a weird one, everybody. This is called Diabolical Inheritance, a.k.a. Herencia Diabolica. This is the Mexican child's play. It was shot in 1993 and was thought to be forever lost, but it was reissued by a new imprint that is on Vinegar Syndrome. It's a VHS label called DeGauser Video. It's in this gorgeous cardboard big box tape.
Beautiful.
Has a clear cover. It has LED lights inside of the shell of the cassette. Yeah. It's really beautiful. It was very painful to open because I kind of wanted to keep it sealed forever. But, you know, toys were meant to be opened and played with.
Gotta watch these
films
tapes.
Were meant to be opened and watched. So, I just had to do it. But this probably isn't too useful of a recommendation for most folks in the UK. It's an NTSC format tape. But you can find it online. And I do have to talk about it because it is one of the weirdest and most uncomfortable films I've ever seen. Basically, a businessman inherits an estate from his wealthy loner aunt, and his pregnant wife, after they move in, finds a large clown doll hidden upstairs in a closet, and then she keeps finding it in random places around the house. So it's kind of like a naughty, creepy elf on the shelf.
Oh.
But it's more like a clown with a frown.
Oh, there you go.
It just might be possessed by the spirit of the aunt's horny dead husband. This is not a good film. Actually,
sounds good.
I don't know. It's astonishingly awful, but it's one of the strangest things I've ever seen. I belly laughed on more than one occasion. If you enjoy international knockoffs of popular American horror films, then this is a must see. But be prepared for some very uncomfortable moments, including one where his wife believes that she's having a nightmare, but she's actually being groped by the clown. And I have to really underscore that this clown is normally a doll, but when it's moving, it's played by an elderly little person in clown makeup. So my hat's off to them for taking a chance on this insane film. I mean, DeGauser really has done us all a service by putting it out. It's a spectacular release, but it will surely befuddle everybody who watches it.
I'm absolutely going to watch that. Amazing. And we are recording this before the Oscars, which will be all over the news as this goes up on Monday. So I don't know who won, but I did manage to watch almost all of the Best Picture nominees this year, all except Poor Things. And my favorite of those nominees, absolutely Killers of the Flower Moon. I loved it. But Anatomy of a Fall and Zone of Interest are also complex, dark, weird nominees. It's like a really great year. Godzilla Minus One is in with a chance at a VFX Oscar, and it would be incredible if a Godzilla movie wins an Academy Award. I do think it's Oppenheimer's year. I think that's pretty obvious. Chrissy Nolan is going to finally get his Oscar and hopefully make an insane horror movie next. He needs to now he's got the Oscar thing over and done with. He can stop trying that and he can make his Shining finally. Incredible year for Best Picture nominees. I'd be happy if any of them won, except for Barbie and Maestro. I think it's embarrassing that both of those have been nominated. They're fucking awful. But yeah, the least likely to win Best Picture is probably American Fiction. There's been no real hype about it, but I caught up with it in the last couple of weeks and I loved it so much. It's thoughtful, moving, and very, very funny. It's an excellent exploration of many different types of grief, not just the grief that comes with death, but there's a lot of loss in this film, let's put it that way. But it's in the form of razor-sharp social satire. Yeah, American Fiction, it's not going to win Best Picture. It might win some sort of scripting award, but I think that's all it's going to get. But it's fucking fantastic.
I cannot wait to see that.
Very much recommend it. Yeah, it's so good. You're going to love it, Shay. You're
Love it. It reminded me of Hollywood Shuffle in the description.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, it's like a kind of slightly more mid.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, more drama-y style, but still with the humour. But just not quite as hilariously funny as Hollywood Shuffle. Man, I love that film too. But yeah, American Fiction, I recommend it. What's next from you?
Well, my next recommendation feels like it came from another planet, but it is A Garage Rock Planet in 1997. This is a film that I think only had one Blu-ray reissue, maybe about 4 or 5 years ago. I suspect it was produced by the filmmaker himself. I don't think that a company picked this up. It's called The Sore Losers.
Oh.
It was made by John Michael McCarthy, and it stars Garage Rock and Estrus Records darlings Jack Oblivion from The Oblivions and Mike Maker from The Makers. And it features, of course, The Makers, but also The Drags and Guitar Wolf on the soundtrack.
Amazing.
And yeah, this is a film about an alien serial killer. He's played by Oblivion, who returns to Earth to complete a murder spree that he had started in the early 50s around Memphis, Tennessee. It's filmed on 16mm. It has non-traditional actors. And The Sore Losers is really a love letter to everything that McCarthy was obsessed with. He was really into EC Comics, to UFO conspiracy theories, exploitation cinema of the 60s. I think like David Friedman is even in this. Mm. He's associated with H.G. Lewis, and mm-hmm. he brought a lot of exploitation films to theaters in the 60s and 70s. And garage rock, 50s obsessed subcultures of the 90s, like the punk rock pinups and the greased out rockers and creeper shoes. It's kind of also the movie's downfall a little bit. It's kind of self-aware, a bit showy, kind of like stepping into a record collector's living room and getting the spiel about everything that's in there. But it has a ton of heart, a lot of creative backyard effects, really clever kills. It's kind of a horror film in disguise. And an absolutely raging, ear-splitting garage rock soundtrack. It is like a turned-down, southern-fried, candy-colored cousin of movies like Burst City and Blood Orgy of the Leather Girls.
Wow, sounds incredible.
Yeah, has Diesel on its biker boots, a stolen guitar strapped to its back, and blood in its pompadour.
Hell yeah. Wow, wow, wow. That sounds astonishing. I'll have to watch it. And yeah, just one more quick recommendation from me. You may have noticed that I'm recommending films again and not just books. And the reason for this is pretty weird and unexpected. But I watched a movie that reignited my passion for cinema recently. And it was directed by Eli Roth.
Oh my God.
Yes.
Is it Thanksgiving?
It's Thanksgiving.
It's so, so good.
Yeah, it's fucking incredible. And part of the reason I say it's fucking incredible is because I had very low expectations going into it. You know, I do like some of Eli's stuff. I'm one of the people that likes Hostel and Hostel Part 2. But he has made some right old shit in recent years. Sorry, Eli, if you're listening to this. I wasn't a fan of Green Inferno, for example. But Thanksgiving, everything is forgiven. This is as true a slasher movie as I've seen in, I don't know, maybe 20 years. I don't know. It just feels like the slasher movies that I grew up with in a really smartly updated, clever way. Again, it's another movie that I watched with Dylan, perhaps inappropriately, but he really wanted to see it. And it is, you know, it is crazy violent, but we both had so much fun with it. It really felt like I'd been transported back in time. Yeah, just wonderful, wonderful.
It's really tough to be self-aware and educated in a certain genre and steeped in it and to actually bring something new to the table.
Yes.
This feels like the film that Quentin Tarantino can be very proud of and actually continue to extol the virtues of Eli Roth with.
Yes, exactly. Like there's a line in Cinema Speculation where he lists like Eli Roth as one of the all-time great genre directors. And I was like, really? But then maybe he'd seen Thanksgiving when he wrote that.
Because, maybe.
You know, it's a fucking amazing, amazing slasher movie.
He saw the trailer for sure.
Yeah, that's true. He did. And that's the other thing. Like, this is another reason that it really works for me. The trailer had the topless bouncing on the trampoline and very kind of juvenile and plays into some of the things I don't like about Eli Roth. But then you watch Thanksgiving, the movie, and that scene starts to get going and you're like, oh my God, we're going to have to sit through this. And I'm thinking, right, I need to like tell Dylan to shut his eyes. But then it comes and goes without any of that. It's just moves on and he's learnt restraint. Eli Roth has learnt the power of restraint.
Oh my God. I
can't believe I'm saying it. But yeah, Thanksgiving, really recommend it, even if you have avoided it because, you know, his Green Inferno and Knock Knock and all the rest of it. Not good.
I guess we can't judge Eli Roth movies by their cover anymore.
No, or even by their director. But
good point.
That's it for this week. Next time, as I said at the top of the show, we'll be returning with Conan the Barbarian.
Oh my God, I'm going to watch so many sword and sandal movies before then. I cannot wait.
Yeah, and this is another film that both Shay and I grew up with and absolutely adore. So stay tuned for another love-in. I can't wait to dig into the extras for that one. But yeah, before we go, Shay, do you have any social media platforms you'd like people to follow you on?
Oh, sure. I'm on Letterboxd under Ronnie Spector, like the ghost, spelled that way. Or on Instagram under my label name, Black The Video, otherwise known as Black Widio.
Yes.
That's, you know.
Like the Vivitch.
Like video with, yeah, thank you, with two Vs.
Yes.
I'm on there. And that's about it. Facebook, I guess. But it's kind of the same thing at this point. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah.
And what about you?
Oh, me? People can get me on Goodreads. Just search for Sam Ashurst and you see what books I'm reading at the moment.
The list is like a scroll at this point.
Yes. And I'm going through a bit of a Beatles read at the moment. I think when I bought my 8th Beatles book recently.
Understatement.
Shay did say that she thinks I might have a bit of a problem.
I did. I still think you do.
Yeah, but
but it's okay.
If you want to know what Beatles books I'm reading, then Goodreads. If you'd rather follow what's going on in the world of like film and comics and all that kind of stuff, then get me on Instagram. It's Sam Ashurst 23, the number 2, the number 3. That's all I've got right now. So, any final thoughts, Shay?
Well, yeah, I'd just like to thank everybody for coming out to play. Can you dig it?
Amazing. Thank you so much for listening. And we promise to be more professional next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.